speaker today will be Javier Olmedo, who's going to speak about customer effect on a quantum geometry. Javier.
Okay. Hello. Thank you for being here. I want to acknowledge the organizer for letting me give this talk. Today we are going to talk about the Casimir effect on loop quantum gravity. This work has been done in collaboration with Rodolfo Gambini and Jorge Pulling. Let us go to slide number one. Before starting with the problem, I would like to motivate it. Recently, we have been able to understand the quantization of spherically symmetric vacuum space-time in loop quantum gravity. These space-time are interesting, obviously, because they contain the solution, the classical level of black hole space-time. This quantization has been done without any gauge fixing, and it provides a physical picture such that the singularity is solved, as well as the geometry shows a kind of discretization due to the quantization of the areas of the spheres of symmetry. Therefore, it is interesting to ask what this model has to do about Hawking radiation, black hole evaporation, or even gravitational collapse. About Hawking radiation, there has been a recent study done by Rodolfo Gambini and Jorge Pulling where they show that the traditional quantities that used to be ill-defined, in the sense that they are divergent, in this discrete geometry they become naturally regularized and finite. About the black hole evaporation, the situation is more involved. In particular, one of the most common treatment of this problem involves the stress energy tensor, which codifies the density and flux energy of the spheres. In the traditional treatment, this quantity used to be ill-defined in the sense that it also is divergent, and additional considerations are necessary in order to have a well-defined quantity, like, for instance, the regularization and renormalization. However, as we will see, these quantities are going to be naturally regularized due to the discreteness of the geometry in this loop description. Essentially, the reason is because there are Transplanckian modes that, due to the discretization of the geometry, cannot propagate. For instance, those modes which has typical length smaller than the discretization of the geometry. Therefore, now it is interesting to us, before dealing with the full problem of black hole evaporation, which these results has to do, or the way in which they can affect the traditional quantum field theory prediction, like, for instance, the phenomenon of the Casimir effect. Let us go now to slide number two. This is the plan of the talk. We are going to give a brief review about the how to calculate, or which is the standard calculation about the vacuum the polarization of the vacuum for a test scalar field in a sparse field geometry. Afterwards, we are going to sketch the main aspect of the quantization about the spherically symmetric vacuum space-time in loop quantum gravity. I will determine which are the effective geometries we are going to consider, and as well as I am going to give the calculation, or not all the details, but the main result about the calculation of the polarization of the vacuum in this discrete geometries. And finally, we are going to going through the Casimir effect. We are going to give the standard details or the computation of the standard result in quantum field theory, and finally compare them with our calculation within this discrete geometry in loop quantum gravity. Okay, let us go to slide number three. For the calculation of the vacuum polarization in sparse geometry, I will follow a paper due to Candelas in the 1980s. Essentially, one considers there a massless scalar field on a sparse geometry, expand the field in MOS, and studies the radial functions, which are the functions that codify the non-trivial geometry of the Schwarzschild spacetime. In particular, these radial functions satisfy or fulfill a second order differential equation in the tortoise coordinate with a given potential, which codifies both the information about the Schwarzschild geometry as well as the contribution of the centrifugal force that appears typically in those modes we have non-zero angular momentum. Here, Rs is the Schwarzschild radius. This equation has two independent solutions, and we are going to choose them by means of some boundary conditions compatible with the Boulware vacuum. In particular, I will compute the expectation on the polarization of the vacuum for this particular Boulware vacuum just for convenience, in order to show which are the problems that arise in this computation and how they can be solved. Okay, let us go to slide number 4. If we compute the polarization of the vacuum without any consideration, the result is ill-defined. We obtain infinite. Therefore, in order to avoid this quantity or this problem, we introduce the so-called two-point function. Essentially, this function allows us to regularize the polarization of the vacuum. In the sense, we are evaluating the expectation value of the product of two fields evaluated in two different space-time points, and one can see that whenever one takes the limit of the two space-time points coinciding, this two-point function goes with the inverse of the geodesic distance separating these two space-time points. Therefore, this quantity obviously is going to be divergent. Now, once we have been able to identify the problematic terms which give the divergences, we can proceed to renormalize this quantity. And the trick essentially consists in subtract the problematic terms. For instance, we can define the renormalized polarization of the vacuum in equation 2, which is essentially the standard contribution subtracting the problematic terms. And at the end of the day, for this particular Boulware vacuum, we end with the last term, which is finite, whenever we do not evaluate it on the horizon of the black hole. Having said this, let us go to slide number 5. I will then start explaining the main details about the quantization of black hole in quantum gravity. In particular, one of the problems that has impeded us to provide a complete quantization of this kind of space-time is essentially because the constraint algebra contains structure functions. For this reason, the application of the Virag approach to this problem used to be not inconsistent due to the system of these structure functions. However, last year, Rodolfo Gambini and Jorge Puni realized that for three-dimensional black holes it is possible to redefine the constraint algebra in a suitable way, such that now becomes a truly algebra. In particular, the modification consists in redefining the scalar constraint in a consistent way on the classical level, such that it can be written as a total derivative. This can be seen in equation 3 of slide number 5. Once it has been done, one can check that the new constraint algebra is the standard one with the diffeomorphism constraint, but the scalar constraint now commutes with itself. Therefore, we can apply to this constraint algebra the Dirac quantization approach in order to see whether quantum gravity phenomena appears in this kind of space-time. Before doing this, it is necessary to consider suitable boundary conditions of this problem in order to have a well-posed problem, and this boundary condition introduces a global degree of freedom which corresponds to the mass of the black hole. Let us go to slide number 6. For the quantization, one considers a kinematical Hilbert space which is going to be the tensor product of the Hilbert space of the global degree of freedom corresponding to the mass of the black hole times the Hilbert space of the spin network. Here, the spin networks are one-dimensional graphs which codifies which are a combination of edges and vertices. The edges has valences which correspond to chi's there, and they codify the information about the area of the Fischer symmetry of the model. And for the valences of the vertices, they are codified in a mu parameter, which is a real number. Let me recall that the valences of the edges are integer numbers, therefore the areas of the spheres are quantized. Having said this, we can proceed to look for the physical states. They are given essentially by a basis of states, such that when we impose the diffeomorphism constraint, essentially this constraint only relates one-dimensional graph in the same equivalent class, such that all these graphs are related by diffeomorphisms. While for the scalar constraint, when it is applied to this state, it constrains the degrees of freedom on the vertices. Therefore, we remain with a basis of state which are essentially labeled by the sequences of the areas of symmetry, that is the chi's, and the mass of the black hole. Let us go to slide number 7. In this quantization, we can also identify the observables of the model, which are essentially the mass, in agreement with the other alternative quantization done for this spherically symmetric spacetime. And there is a new observable genuine of the loop quantization, which codifies these sequences of the valences of the edges, and it depends on a parameter theta that takes values from 0 to 1, and this, depending on the value of this parameter, this is telling us which particular link of the spin network we are evaluating this observable. Here, V is the number of vertices of the state, of the physical state. We can also define, for instance, other more general observables in terms of these two Dirac observables, the so-called parametrized Dirac observables by means of the evolving constant techniques. Essentially, one promotes classical quantities, which are not gauge invariant, to true Dirac observables by means of these initial or fundamental Dirac observables and some gauge-dependent function. For instance, we can see this in equation 4 and 5. Essentially, in equation 4, we have the triad in the radial direction evaluating in a given point, and it can be defined as an observable by means of this gauge-dependent function, theta, which depends on x, and depending which is the particular form of this theta function, we are considered when one radial coordinate or another. Also, we can define more complicated observable, like for instance the metric component GTX, in terms again of parameterized observables and some gauge dependent function or parameters. Let us go to slide number 8. Here I will set the FFT geometries we are going to consider in the following. In particular, we are going to consider states which are superposition of the mass, but they have to be highly peaked on a given particular mass, therefore we can neglect fluctuations. And for the sequences of the spherosymmetry, we are going to select them such that they grow monotonically and have small differences between consecutive spheres. This will give a very good approximation of the continuum spacetime. In particular, the discretization of the area, or the quantization of the area of symmetries, will induce a discretization in the radial direction. We are going to select them as spin network such that it provides a uniform lattice for the tortoise coordinate. where the step of the lattice delta is not going to be fixed, but it has to fulfill a lower bound. It cannot be smaller than a given quantity, which essentially is the square of the Planck length divided by the spatial radius on the exterior of the black hole. Okay, this is the considerations we need for the FFT geometry. Now we are going to introduce a scalar field, a massless scalar field. Of course, it will have support on the vertices of the spin network, therefore it will only will take values on the uniform lattice. Let us go to slide number 9. Then we can proceed as we did in the beginning. We can solve the radial equation for the MOS, which in this case is going to be a difference equation, not a differential one. We can find the radial functions fulfilling the boundary condition compatible with the forward vacuum, and compute the polarization of the vacuum in this situation. Either if we are far away in the spatial infinity or close to the horizon, which is equation 6 and 7 of slide number 9, we obtain in both cases a finite result. In both situations, this regularized polarization of the vacuum is depend on the inverse of the square of the step of the lattice, and it is obviously finite because there are some Transplanckian modes, those with frequencies higher than the length of the, or with typical length smaller than the step of the lattice, which are not present or are suppressed due to the discretization of the geometry. Therefore, before dealing with the full treatment of the black hole evaporation, it is enlightening to understand what of what these results, in which manner can affect other prediction of quantum field theory, like for instance the Casimir effect. Therefore, we are going to learn now the problem of the black hole evaporation, and we are going to study the Casimir effect in the following. Let us go to slide number 10. Essentially, the Casimir effect is a phenomenon that appears in an intuitive picture due to the fact of the following. If we confine a field within a bound region of the space-time, there is something that happens. There are some modes which are able to propagate in the whole space-time, those modes with typical length higher than the size of the, or the typical size of the boundary region, that in the interior of this boundary region cannot propagate. Therefore, the result is that when you compute the vacuum energy of the scalar of the field inside and outside of these regions, there is a difference of energy. The vacuum energy is different. Then this translates in an effective force that is acting on the boundaries of this bounded region of the space-time. Then we are going to proceed to evaluate this the energy of the Casimir effect for a problem compatible with the symmetries of the space-time we are considering here. In particular, I will start with giving the main details about the calculation in the continuum, and then I will go through the calculation in this discrete geometry. In the continuum, we are going to, in both cases, we are going to consider two concentric spherical slabs, one small one that has radius r0 and the bigger one which has radius r0 plus l, and we are going to consider that the spherical slab are much bigger than the radius of the black hole, therefore we are far away in the spatial infinity, as well as the separation between these two spherical slabs, or the difference between the radius is given by L, is much more smaller than the typical length of them. Then we can proceed to the decomposition of the scalar field confined in this region of the space-time and study their radial functions. We then solve the radial equation, second order, and impose the Dirichlet boundary conditions, since the scalar field has to be confined between the two slabs. This equation within this asymptotic region of the space-time can be solved and essentially given in a good approximation by a linear combination of Bessel functions of first and second kind. Let us go to slide number 11. About the frequencies, they depend on, obviously, on the angular momentum of the mouse as well as on a given label n. They are discrete because not all the frequencies are compatible with the Dirichlet boundary conditions, and I will identify this label n with the wave number of the mouse. In order to compute the Casimir energy, one of the procedures one can follow is simply evaluating the sum on all the frequencies of all the modes in the problem. Obviously, this quantity is going to be infinite because we are sum an infinite quantity of modes of energy of the modes. However, it is well known that there are well-known techniques in order to regularize these infinite series, like for instance the Riemann and the zeta function. In particular, I will follow work due to OSCAN of 2012, where it evaluates this sum. In particular, the treatment consists in separating this sum for very high angular momentum and finite wave number with respect to the very high wave number series for finite angular momentum. Then, if we use a convergency factor together with the integral representation of the Cauchy theorem, it is possible to see that the contribution for very high angular momentum is essentially zero. This is due, in fact, or the intuitive picture is given because the Bessel function for very high angular momentum are going to be suppressed in the interior of this of these slabs. Therefore, the only contribution which is relevant for the computation of the energy is due to the very high wave number series. This quantity can be computed and regularized by means of the Abela-Plana formula, and it yields the standard result, which is given in equation 10. Let me remark that it is a negative energy, therefore the force acting on the slabs is going to be attractive, and it decreases with the separation of the slabs, with the field power of the separation of the slabs. And everything is multiplied by a given numerical number. Okay, then we go to the main point of this talk, which is the computation of the Casimir effect on this discrete geometry. Let us go to slide number 12. For it, we are going to follow a different strategy. What we are going to do is to evaluate the 0-0 component of the stress energy tensor. This treatment is going to be more in agreement with the computation that one would do for the study of the black hole evaporation. In particular, we are going to consider the so-called improved stress energy tensor provided by Fulin that avoids some spurious singularities. About the FT geometry, as I said before, we are going to consider a uniform discretization in the spin network, providing a uniform discretization in the radial direction. Let me recall that in the spatial infinity, the tortoise and the radial coordinate coincide, and the step of the lattice, again, is not going to be fixed, but it has to fulfill a smallest value possible that it can take. This smallest value in the region where we are is going to be given by the square of the Planck length divided by 2 times the radius of one of the slabs. The smallest slab, in fact. Now we can proceed to solve the radial equation of the radial modes of the scalar field confined in the interior of the slabs. This equation, which is equation 11, is a difference equation. It can be solved, for instance, employing numerical techniques. At the analytical level, we don't know if there is any closed form for the solutions as well as the dispersion relation. Therefore, one of the strategies in order to solve in an exact way is to adopt numerical techniques or something similar, or either accept or incorporate some approximations in order to solve the problem analytically. And this is what we are going to do in this talk. Then, let us go to slide number 13. Then these are the first set of approximations that we are going to take into account. Let me notice before that the sums involved in equation 12, in the mode decomposition of the scalar field, there is a sum in the wave number, in the number n, which is finite, and this is due to the discretization of the geometry. We are not doing anything here. But regarding the sum in the angular momentum, we are going to introduce a cutoff. This is one of the first approximations. This cutoff is motivated by the asymptotic behavior of the Bessel function for very high angular momentum. This cutoff allows us also to replace in equation 12 the Bessel functions by sinusoidal functions. Let me recall that this sinusoidal function fulfills the boundary conditions, and also the difference equation in equation 11 in a good approximation. Together with this replacement, we also can deduce which is in a good approximation the dispersion relation given in equation 13. It contains the standard term that one would have in a discrete or a theory in the lattice, plus one term that codifies the information about the energy of those modes with non-vanishing angular momentum. Okay, let us go to slide number 14. In order to calculate the expectation value of the stress energy tensor, we are going to use the two-point function. Let me recall at this point, in order to avoid any confusion, the following point. Even when at the beginning we introduced the two-point function in order to regularize the polarization of the vacuum, in this case we are not using it for any kind of regularization. We are using it for convenience in our calculations. The regularization of the quantities becomes or appears due to the discretization of the geometry. Therefore, as we will see later, even when we evaluate the two-point function in the very same space-time point, all the quantities are going to be finite. With this remark, we are going to introduce the second set of approximation in our calculations. We are now in slide number 14. And equation 14 codifies the two-point function once we have approximated the sums by the integrals. As well as the integral in the angular momentum, we only keep those dominant terms and neglect the subdominant contributions. This is the second set of approximations in our calculation. Let me also notice that in equation 14, the sinusoidal function depends on the theta coordinate, which is the coordinate inside the slabs. Okay, let us go to slide number 15. Now, we need to evaluate some quantities previous to the computation of the expectation value of the 0,0 component of the stress energy tensor. These quantities are the expectation value of the square of the time derivative of the scalar field and the expectation value of the square of the spatial derivative of the scalar field, which is equation 15 and 16, respectively. These expectation values can be obtained by deriving twice the Green function with respect to time or with respect to the radial coordinate, respectively, and evaluating the result in the very same space-time point. At this level, if we were in the continuum theory, these quantities will be divergent. But in this case, they become, due to the discretization of the geometry, finite. And you can see this because they are written in terms of a factor multiplied by an integral, which is a definite integral and finite. Let me also remark that these integrals can be computed explicitly, but I will not do it here because the result is rather lengthy. Also, the last 10 in equation 17, which involves the probable expectation value of the scalar field times the second derivative of the scalar field, can be determined as well in terms of the square or the expectation value of the square of the time derivative of the scalar field. Therefore, we have all the ingredients we need in order to compute the stress energy tensor. Let us go to the next slide, slide number 16. Then we can compute the stress 0,0 component of the stress energy tensor, whether if we evaluate it in a point inside the slabs or in the inner slab for theta equal to 0, which corresponds to equation 18 and 19, and we expand the result for a small lattice step, we obtain in both cases that the stress energy tensor is finite. It also has two terms which are the responsible of the divergent divergences in the continuum, in the limit in which we take the step of the lattice going to zero, but since our effective description always has a finite step, all these quantities will remain finite. Then let us go to slide number 17. In order to compute the Casimir energy, what we do is subtract the contribution that one would have if there were a scalar field confined in between two spherical slabs, but this time the separation between them is a separation much more bigger than the separation of our problem. If we subtract this contribution and we integrate the result between 0 and L, between the slabs, we obtain in equation 20 the desired result. In particular, we can compare it with the standard result. It has the correct sign in the sense that it will give a negative force for the slabs. It decays, the energy decays with the third power of the separation of the slabs, but the numerical factor multiplying is different from the standard one. We believe that this difference arises because of the several approximations we are considering in our computation. And this is support, for instance, because we have computed the energy for only the mode which has a vanishing angular momentum, which essentially coincides with the Casimir energy of a scalar field in a one-dimensional lattice, and we obtain the exact result in equation 21. Okay, then I am done. Let me summarize the results. In particular, we have been able to apply techniques of quantum field theory on a quantum spherically symmetric vacuum space-time in order to compute the polarization of the vacuum. We have seen that due to the discretization of the geometry, all the calculations are naturally regularized and all the results and then finite. Therefore, no additional regularization considerations are necessary in this calculation. In particular, we have been able to compute in full detail the Casimir energy for a scalar field between two concentric spherical slabs, and we have obtained, after some approximation, the correct behavior for this Casimir energy, but with a different factor, multiplying a different numerical factor with respect to the standard computations. Therefore, the conclusion we achieve here is that we are able to reproduce the result, but we need to improve the approximations in order to improve the accuracy of our calculation. And of course, we have to think how to extend all these techniques to more general situations in order to deal, for instance, with black hole evaporation or even gravitational collapse. Okay, thank you so much.
Questions?
My question is like, out of the approximations, like which approximation do you think is a suspect which is causing this discrepancy? Do we have some insights on which approximation may be going wrong?
Yeah, there are, I think that all the approximations we are considering, all of them are introducing a kind of error. In particular, if we go to slide number 13, we are replacing, we are introducing a cutoff in equation 12 for the summation of the angular momentum, and we are replacing the corresponding Bessel function by sinusoidal function. Within this cutoff, this approximation is good, but probably we are missing some contributions for higher angular momentum, not much higher than this one, but a little bit higher, that can affect the calculations. As well as we are modifying the dispersion, we are approximating the dispersion relation in equation 15, which also affects on the computation of the different integrals, as well as the replacement of the sums by the integrals in equation 14, in slide 14, also give additional errors in our computation. Therefore, all these approximations will somehow affect the final numerical value.
So, coming back to the cutoff, like, can you please explain, like, why you really need this cutoff? Because this is a very naive question, but suppose you have L. If L was taking very large values, those signs will anyway regularize it, right? So, my suspicion is that by ignoring those very high values of L, you are introducing some error in the computation.
Mm-hmm.
So, is there some way like one can formulate it such that one can see the effect of the cutoff or eliminate it?
My impression is that, first of all, if you want to improve the cutoff, you have to use probably numerical techniques. Essentially, if you want to do it analytically, either you know which is the, for instance, the dispersion relation of, as well as the radial functions, or you have to do everything in the computer. Also, let me comment at this point that the angular, the cutoff in the angular momentum is going to appear anyway, in the following sense. If you consider the problem for very high angular momentum modes, what you can see is that the sinusoidal behavior of this function becomes like a behavior in terms of Bessel functions. Therefore, the centrifugal potential start to confine the contributions of the mode for high angular momentum in one of the slabs. Therefore, they start to be compressed and compressed and compressed in the moment you are increasing and increasing the angular momentum. There is going to be an angular momentum where the typical wave of these Bessel functions is going to be smaller than the size of the step of the lattice. Therefore, at that moment, the solutions or the radial modes are expected to be highly suppressed in the computation. Therefore, it is expected that they are not going to contribute. But of course, the cutoff is going to be probably of the order of the Planck length. Therefore, one has to go beyond and include additional modes. But my impression is that the computation we are doing here is probably doing the best within analytical techniques. One has to improve the calculation, one has to probably need the computer.
I have a more conceptual question, in particular in the last part. Maybe you can go to slide number 17. So, or 16, mm-hmm. Both. So, my impression is that at the end of the day, what you are computing is the difference in energy density or energy between the energy of two spherical shells very close together and two spherical shells separated far apart. So, you do this because is your opinion that this is the real physical quantity, or because you just want to compare with the standard Casimir results? And also, I am confused with what you call energy, because if you go to slide number 17, this E has dimensions of 1 over L cubed, which is energy to cube, if H bar is equal to 1. So what is the meaning of that quantity called energy here?
Yeah, this is because this is, for the last question, this is the density energy for per unit of the area of the slab.
Per unit area.
Exactly. And about the first question, yes, we are subtracting a contribution. This is, on the one hand, has to be done because you want to compare with the standard results, and this is the way of doing it. Otherwise, if you compute the Casimir energy without subtracting anything, you will have the dominant terms are going to be of the order of Planck length, essentially.
And that is not in agreement with the standard?
Yes, probably one has to think how to treat this contribution.
Is your view that what makes physical sense is the difference itself, or?
Yeah, I mean, when you are, for instance, in a quantum, studying the hydrogen atom, you always also are interested in difference between the energies. You can, or you have a notion which are the absolute energies, but at the end of the day, what you observe, for instance, in the spectrogram or something, is the difference of the energy. Therefore, in this is a motivation for consider differences of energy. But I have no definite answer for that question.
Thank you.
Other questions? Okay, let's thank the speaker again.